as I'm concerned. Joyce was dutifully waiting for me at the airport, and she had Margaret covering the other door. You know, that's how it is when Al-Anons pick you up at the airport. They cover all the doors. You know, alcoholics pick you up at the airport. They're in the parking lot waiting. You got to find them, you know. So, so I definitely knew I was at an Al-Anon function. Anyway, and I've kind of had a rough couple days because I've had this, I just came down with this really bad head cold, and then on the plane coming out here, I got a bloody nose, you know, sitting in the middle seat between two big old guys. You know how compassionate men are when women are bleeding. So, anyway, if I was in my home group and I was saying this story, they would all be going, aww. I know, exactly. Woe is me, woe is me. But anyway, I'm going to try and just tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like for me today, and try not to cough or get a bloody nose in the middle of it. So so if I keep going like this, it's because I'm nervous. And but anyway, I'm the oldest of four kids. My dad was a master sergeant in the Army, so that made me the automatic corporal of my family. From the very beginning, I've always been in charge because I don't remember not ever having brothers or sisters. We kind of came in fairly rapid succession, and so I was just always in charge. My husband jokes that I came out of the womb carrying a clipboard and wearing an armband, and he's not too far off the mark. Ever since I can remember, too, when I was in school, I was always playground monitor, cafeteria monitor, you know, classroom monitor, because, you know, I'm good at that. You know, when if anybody's not doing what they're supposed to be doing, you know, by God, I will write down their name and I will report them. And, you know, I don't have a problem doing that. I don't care if I'm in the fourth grade and they're in the sixth grade. You know, if they're breaking the rules, I think it ought to be reported. And so, like I say, that's just always kind of been my deal. And I have that air about me sometimes today. I mean, my husband and I can be at a restaurant waiting for a table, and people will come up to me and they'll go, is it okay if we push these two tables together? You know, and I go, sure, it's fine with me. And, you know, it's always okay. I don't mind. You know, and because if you want an answer, I will give you one, whether I have any information based or not, you know, because I can't stand a void. You know, and if you're waiting to hear something, I'm going to fill it up. And if you need direction, I'm your person, you know. And again, this is part of the reasons why I'm in the program that I'm in today. But anyway, I grew up in this house, and it was a military house. My dad, like I say, he was a master sergeant in the Army. He had a voice, you know, that could take the roof off of the joint. And we had a lot of physical violence in my house growing up, but the worst was the verbal. I mean, my dad was just, he could just scare the bejeebies out of us. I mean, he'd call your name, and four kids would instantaneously pee their pants on the spot, you know, just to find out that dinner was ready, you know. But you never knew, you know, because another time you might call your name, and you might find yourself across the room. And, you know, and I had absolutely no idea that my dad had a problem with drinking, you know, or that alcohol was a problem. How do you know that, you know, when that's a part of your life from the very beginning? You know, my dad was a daily drinker. I don't possess a memory nor a possession of him, you know, that he doesn't have a can of beer in his hand. It's just what went on in my house, and what I know today is just normal behavior in an alcoholic home. It's not anything extraordinary or out of the ordinary. But anyway, like I say, I had absolutely no idea that it was the disease of alcoholism. You know, my dad just drank every day, and there was a lot of yelling that went on in my house. And, you know, and like I say, you're not born with any kind of a manual that says, this is what normal behavior is, and this is what bad behavior is. And not only that, you know, because we were in the military, we always lived with other military families. And there was a lot of drinking going on in the military. My dad wasn't the only dad that was drinking all the time or getting drunk or doing those kinds of things. And, you know, and there was a lot of women walking around with black eyes and that type of stuff. And it was never, you know, that was normal for what I grew up in. I didn't think that was anything out of the ordinary. My idea of regular life is, you know, is dads go to the Army, then they come home, then they get drunk. You know, and then, you know, there's a blowout. Somebody always gets hurt, or somebody gets court-martialed, or somebody goes to the brig, or something like that. But that's just the routine. You know, I'd wake up on Saturday and Sunday mornings and walk into our living room, and there'd be a pyramid of beer cans, in the living room from the party that my parents had the night before. It was just typical. Again, I had absolutely no idea that drinking played any part in the stuff that went on in our life. You know, and for a long time, I thought that my dad was just really a mean man. You know, I had absolutely no idea that the alcohol triggered that in him, you know, that was his reaction to alcohol was violent, angry. You know, but for a very long time, I just thought he was a really mean man, and I could never figure out why somebody would go to the trouble of getting married, you know, and having children just so he could be mad all the time, you know, at them. I just, you know, again, I never connected, you know, the drinking part of that. You know, but again, what I've come to learn in Al-Anon is that's just typical behavior in an alcoholic home. There's nothing, you know, out of the ordinary or strange or unusual about it. It's just what goes on. And when I was really new in Al-Anon, I went to lots and lots of Open Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And if you're new here, I can't recommend enough, you know, that you do go to Open AA meetings. It says in our Al-Anon literature that we should learn all we can about the disease of alcoholism. And I don't know any place better to learn that than in Open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've learned a lot of really valuable things there. And like I say, in the very beginning when I was first going, and I can't remember, you know, but right somewhere in the beginning there, I went with my husband to an AA speaker meeting. And the speaker that night, now whether or not this is what he shared or not, what I heard him talk about that whole night was alcoholism, the family disease. You know, that to me is the talk that I heard him talk about. And he just basically talked about alcoholism in the family and the effect that it had on the family. And he said that, you know, alcoholism in the family is like having a rhinoceros in your living room, but everybody pretends it's a coffee table. You know, and that's the perfect description of the family that I grew up in, because it would get like, you know, as we got older and things went on, you know, my mom would get to the point where she could tell when my dad was ready to have one of his alcoholic explosions, but she could never say to us kids, okay, now everybody be quiet, nobody say anything, everybody look down at your plate because your dad's ready to blow up, because of course that would cause my father to blow up. You know, so what my mom would do is she would talk to us facially. You know, because what I know today is the first thing that goes out of any alcoholic family is communication skills, verbal of any kind. Those are the first things that go. So my mom would talk to us facially. And if you've lived in an alcoholic home, you know, when people go like this, you know, there's a lot of meaning behind those things. You know, there's like, that's red alert. You know, that's like, you know, something's going to happen. And us kids would all know. My mom would just get the big eyes and, you know, and everybody just start looking at everybody. And we'd all try and be good and not do anything. But if you've got an alcoholic that wants to blow up, it's going to happen. You know, and sure enough, you know, kablooey, it would happen and dinner would go flying and everybody would get sent to bed with a spanking, you know. And this could be 5:30 in the afternoon and everybody's gone to bed. Everybody's sent to bed. You know, the kids, my mom, the dog, everybody's got to go. You know, and then the next morning we'd get up the courage to kind of, you know, creep down the hallway and walk into the kitchen, and there'd be my dad at the breakfast table with his morning can of beer, and we'd walk in the kitchen and it'd be, good morning, what do you want for breakfast? You know, and no one ever said, gee whiz, Dad, what was that about last night? Gee whiz, Dad, how come you had to throw dinner on the floor? Gee whiz, Dad, how come you had to hit everybody? No one said anything, because the rhinoceros just goes back to being a coffee table again. You just hope it's over, and you hope today will be different, and that it's a done deal. You know, and that to me is the perfect description of the alcoholic family that I grew up in. You know, and plus you got to know this was like in the mid-50s, late-50s, early-60s, you know, and nobody ever talked about any of that kind of stuff. Everything, you know, your family stuff was your family stuff. You wouldn't dream of saying anything. You know, how you appeared was everything. And, you know, and my mom made sure that we always looked good. And, you know, and as a family, I'm sure that we did. But you know how people couldn't hear the yelling and the screaming and the ranting and the raving that was going on? You know, today I know they did. But nobody ever talked about those kinds of things. You just, you know, looked away or didn't pay any attention or do whatever. And, you know, and again, how blessed I feel today, you know, that we're in an environment, you know, in a society today where, you know, it's not a big secret anymore. You know, where workplaces have, you know, resources that you can go to, you know, in schools and all, you know, all these places now offer, you know, and plus, you know, and you know, the outreach programs that we have, you know, that we have Alateen and Al-Anons that, you know, that do go to schools and, you know, and carry the message. It's, you know, and that clergy knows so much about it. And I just think it's a really marvelous thing. It's really good. Joyce and I were talking earlier today about, you know, like, you know, I live in the Los Angeles meeting. There's like 600 Al-Anon meetings a week, you know, in the Los Angeles area. You can't be in my group and say you couldn't find a meeting. I mean, that just doesn't go over. You can't even begin to say that. You know, but that's a really huge blessing, and I'm grateful for that. You know, when I first got to Al-Anon, I had huge resentments against my mother. You know, but my dad was the drunk, and he was the mean guy, and he was, you know, and definitely, you know, the big source of, you know, distress in our family. But I was mad at my mom for a long time because she was the one that, you know, let, you know, made a stay in that stuff. I could never understand why she would put up with that behavior, you know, from my dad all the time, and why she would subject her children to that. And you know, and as I've heard many people that come to Al-Anon share, you know, that the resentment against the non-drinking parent is often greater than that of the drinking parent. And, you know, and what I know today coming to Al-Anon, you know, when I started coming here, you know, the first person I wanted to sign up was my mother. And, I mean, I just couldn't wait to give her the good news. And, but my mom didn't want to hear my good news, and she kind of thinks of Al-Anon as a cult thing, and you know, she thinks it's a brainwashing operation. And but at the same token, I can't think of anybody's brains who needs more washing than mine. But But anyway, she's not real fond of it or anything. But of course, that's the message that I wanted her, because, you know, after all this time living with my dad, you know, I knew that her answers would be here. And, you know, and like I say, she wanted absolutely nothing to do with it. She's not the slightest bit interested. And because my mom is the type, you know, that she thinks she handled it all really fine. And, you know, she divorced my dad. I think they were married 24, 25 years when she finally ended up divorcing my dad. And she's very fine, thank you very much. And, you know, and what I've come to learn in Al-Anon is that it's none of my business anymore. You know, if I could give it to the people that I wanted to give it to, my family, boy, wouldn't I deliver it to them on a silver platter. But I don't get to do that. You know, I have to leave that. That's your guys' job. You get to carry the message to my family. My job, I get to carry the message to your family when and if they ever decide to reach out for help. And but what I've come to learn here, too, is that my mom's done the very best she can with what she had. You know, I no longer harbor huge resentments against my mom. My mom lived with the active disease of alcoholism. And and today I'm very comfortable with the fact that she did the best that she could with what she had. She loved us to the best of her ability. I have a pretty good relationship with my mom now. It used to be really hard for me to go see her and visit with her, because she's just kind of, you know, we'd stay at her house and then we would gossip about family, and it was a lot of negative stuff. And so one time when I was talking to my sponsor about going to see my mom, she's like, well, change it, make it be different. You don't have to go there and stay at your mom's house. Put her in the car, go to the mall, go do stuff. You know, so now that's what I do when I go out. My mom lives a couple hours away from me, so when I go to visit with her, I go get her, and we go in the car, we go to the mall, we go to Victoria's Secret, try on dirty underwear. It's just, you know, but again, you know, the abilities we learn in Al-Anon to change, you know, to change it, you know. We don't have to change the people, but you can change some of the stuff that you're doing. If you want to keep participating in the negative behavior, then you keep getting the negative behavior back. But if you're willing to change it up a little bit and do something positive, now my mom looks real forward to these shopping trips, and we really have a good time, and we get to laugh, because I found out my mom wants to laugh. Who doesn't want to have joy in their life? You know, and that's a gift that you guys have given to me. You know, today, you know, one more time, I've learned to love my mother unconditionally. You know, unconditional love, you know, is huge to me in this program. It's not just two little words that kind of sound good together. You know, there is, you know, the longer you're here, the more meaning they actually have. And today I do have unconditional love for my mother, and I learned that from you guys, and I'm really, really grateful for that. But anyway, you know, just growing up in this family, it just got a little bit crazier and crazier, and just got progressively worse as the disease of alcoholism does. I used to ask my mom, "Mom, why did you stay with Dad?" And she said she did it for us kids. You know, so I always told her, "Geez, what can we get you for Christmas?" You know, because we're so grateful. But it was a big deal for me. And when I was in Al-Anon, maybe 6 months, my dad died. My dad was 55 years old when he died, and he died of wet brain, chronic alcoholism. And my dad was just a beer drinker. But again, that's just the way the disease of alcoholism works. And it was a big deal for me. And I was only in Al-Anon a very short amount of time. Like I said, I'd only been coming, I think I started coming in June, and he died in October. And so I wasn't to the loving, forgiving part of the program by any stretch of the imagination at that point. So when my dad died, my big deal about that was, yippee, ding dong, the wicked witch is dead. And that was just my attitude about it. I was glad he was dead. Good riddance to him. We had a very small service for him. I remember, you know, because he had been in the Army, you know, they do offer certain military honors, and they'd done some things, and we had my dad cremated. And I remember the guy coming in his uniform bringing me my dad's ashes. They were brought to me because my mom had divorced him, and I was the executor of his will. So when they brought me the ashes, I was just livid. I was so angry. I took the ashes, and I went down to the garage, and I stuck them on a shelf, and I said, "Now you stay there, and you think about what you did." And because that's just about where I was in the whole deal. Again, you know, years of just the stuff that goes on in the alcoholic home, and it was just like, yeah, you think about it now for a while. And for me, I thought the deal was done. I thought once he was dead, it was over. You know, that part of it was just done. And it's amazing to me because, you know, one more time, it's not the alcoholic, it's the alcoholism. It's the family disease of alcohol and how I am affected by it. Not the person, but the disease of alcoholism. Because amazingly enough, after my dad died, you know, those resentments didn't die, that anger didn't die. That stuff was just bubbling up inside, just keeps surfacing every so often, you know, over and over and over again. And I've always worked with a sponsor, and my first sponsor, Jeannie, I was working with her on this stuff, and I'd done the steps, and And I'd done an inventory on my dad, and I did all the writing, and I did all the stuff that I was directed to do in the program of Al-Anon, you know, about this relationship with my alcoholic parent. And but still, I would have the stuff. Still, the stuff would surface up. And finally, she sat me down one day, and she told me, you know, this is affecting you in a negative way, and because alcoholism, the disease, is a negative disease, you're taking that negativity home. And again, one more time, this vicious circle gets passed on to you and gets passed on to your children, even though you're not drinking, you know, this negative effect that this alcoholism has had on you. And she goes, and you've done all the writing, you've done all the stuff you're supposed to do about, you know, what happened with your dad. She goes, now what I want you to do, you know, we're getting rid of the negative part. She goes, from now on, when you think about your dad, you've done the writing, you've done the stuff. You know, your dad paid the ultimate price for his alcoholism. He died. There's not anything else he can do anymore. So what you need to do is, from now on, when you think about your dad and you think about those bad feelings, she goes, I want you to go home now and I want you to think about one good thing your dad did for you. You know, and I was like, I'm not going to even think of a half a thing my dad did for me. And she's like, no, you pray about it and you go home and just be willing. You know, and that's the big thing in Al-Anon, is just the willingness. So I was willing, you know, and I thought about it, and I don't know how long it took me, a couple weeks, maybe a month, and I remembered that my dad taught me how to drive. And if you're going to marry your own alcoholic, especially in Southern California, driving is an essential tool. You know, you have to have wheels. You have to be a licensed driver if you're going to chase your own alcoholic. And so I was like, so I went to Jeannie and I said, you know what? He taught me how to drive, and I'm grateful for that. And then she says, fine. Now, whenever the stuff starts bubbling up in your head again, I want you to take that negative alcoholism thought. Because that's what alcoholism, that's how it lives on in you. It keeps that negative crap going, and you replace it with that positive thought that he taught you how to drive. You know, and so I did. And then it was amazingly, because it wasn't too long after that I thought about a second thing that my dad did that was good. And it wasn't too long after that I came up with a third thing and a fourth thing. You know, and what I learned from that one more time is, again, alcoholism, the negative disease that I grew up in, it wants you to stay in the negative stuff. There are probably lots of positive things that have always been going on in my life despite the negative disease of alcoholism, but I don't see the good, because that's how I'm affected by the negative disease of alcoholism. I only see the dark side. You know, and that's what I've had to learn here, is to replace that. Now, you know, it's been quite a few years, about 22 years now, since my dad has passed away, you know, and I don't harbor those resentments about him anymore. Today, what I know is he was a sick person. He was a sick person afflicted with the disease of alcoholism, and he paid the ultimate price with his life. And there's not another thing I can do to make that be any different. And what I can do to make that be better is to honor his memory and the fact that, you know, I'm not going to let that disease go on. He wouldn't want me to pass it on to my kids the way that he passed it on to me, if he'd have had the choices that I have today. And that's just how I look at it. And again, how grateful I am to this program that gave me those tools to be able to do those kinds of things. But anyway, when I was about 13 years old, my dad got out of the Army. Now, up until this point, we'd lived in Europe, and we lived all on the East Coast. And when I was 13, he got out of the Army, and we moved to Southern California. Now, this was in the early 60s. Let me tell you, getting out of the Army is one thing. Moving to Southern California in the early 60s was like moving to Mars. I mean, it was like, you know, I grew up with nothing but rules and regulations, you know, and I love it. I think it's great. I mean, I like knowing the rules and regulations of everything. Tell me what you expect of me. That's what I want to know. And that's, you know, I love that stuff. And, you know, and my dad raised us that way pretty much. I mean, he was, you know, we had Army blankets on our bed. We had little footlockers at our, you know, the end of our bed. You know, he'd flip quarters on them and stuff. You know, I loved that sense of duty and honor and, you know, this is what's expected of you. And I was very good at it. It fit well for me. Didn't fit well for my sisters or my brother, but it fit really well for me. So now I'm going from this very rigid rules and regulations thing, and we moved to Southern California, which was like hippy-dippy land. I mean, it was just, everybody was tie-dye and lovey beads, and I mean, it was just absolutely craziness, and my dad hated it. He absolutely hated it. But you know, our family didn't change. We still had all the rules and regulations, except now we were in a non-rule and regulation place. And what ended up happening is us girls started getting older, and, you know, it came time for us to start dating, and it was very, very hard to date in my house because my dad had many rules and regulations about dating. And I'd bring this little weenie boy home to meet my dad because that was one of the rules and regulations. And this guy would sit in front of my dad, and my dad was over 6 foot tall, and he had one eyebrow. He could raise like 6 inches off of his, you know, this one side of his forehead. He looked like the devil himself standing in front of the guy. And then he would drill this guy with the rules and regulations of dating his daughters. You know, what where are you going, what time are you going to be back, and what part of their anatomy he would remove if we were not returned in the virginal condition of which we left the house in the first place. You know, subsequently, very, very hard to get a second date. Very, very hard. It didn't happen very often at all. And, you know, and this is where, again, you know how everybody starts interplaying, you know, in the disease of alcoholism. You know, this is where my mom, you know, this is where I can now look back and see where my mom did the best she could. You know, my dad ruled the house, and he ruled it with an iron fist, and my mom did what she could to try and keep things smooth as best as she could. And so for us girls to have any kind of a semblance of a regular life, she just started lying to my dad. They're at the library. They have a class project after school. You know, they have this, they have that. Again, the typical stuff that goes on. But anyway, when I was 17 years old, I met my husband. I should have known there was something wrong with him because my dad liked him. But that went right over my head, and because my dad never liked anybody that I ever brought home, but he liked my husband, you know, right off the bat. And my husband is, I was 17, and he's several years older than me. He was 23 years old at the time, and he'd been married once before, and now he was living back with his mommy and daddy, which might have been clue number two to me that there wasn't something quite right there, but that went right over my head. And I remember we went on this, we went with this other couple on this date, and we went bowling, and I tried not to beat him at bowling, but it was impossible. And I remember we were going back to his house, you know, where he lives with his mom and dad and his brother and this girl that he was dating, and he stopped at a liquor store. And he turns to me and says, "What would you like to drink?" You know, and I like, "Drink, alcoholically drink?" You know, and he's like, "Yes." And I tell him how I'm 17 years old, and I tell him the rules and regulations of drinking in the state of California, you know, which do not commence until you are 21, thank you very much. But of course, you know, I know what he hears whenever I'm saying stuff he doesn't want to hear. He heard blah, 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 blah. You know, and he proceeded to go right on into the liquor store, and he came back out with a gallon of Red Mountain wine, you know, if nothing else to impress me what he could consume in sheer volume alone. You know, in one date, but we went back to his house, and I ended up drinking some of this wine and getting a little blotto because I have no drinking experience whatsoever. But I'll tell you what I remember the most about that night is what an excellent, wonderful, fun time I had. Because, see, up until that point, even though my husband got drunk that evening, my experience with drinking has always been nothing but violence. You know, it always started out happy. You know, we always started out with these happy army parties and, you know, these little backyard deals going on or whatever. But it wasn't very long before it turned into the violence and the police were involved or, you know, or somebody got court-martialed or somebody got hit. It always turned into a negative event for me. And here I went out on this date with this guy, and he started drinking, and he just got happy. He just got nicer. You know, and we started having fun, and we were laughing, and it ended up that way. You know, and therefore, you know, and this is what I call, this is what starts the chain for me. This is what I call information from nowhere lands here and becomes fact for me. Because I spend a lot of time, you know, thinking. You know, and so I think up crap all the time. It's floating up here. I just pick out pieces randomly, land here, and become fact for me. So that day when we're driving home and I see how just wonderful he is, this is what a person who can drink can handle. This is how a person who can drink can drink. You know, obviously the people I've been around with don't know how to drink because it ends up in these violent things. This guy knows how to handle his liquor. You know, and again, information from nowhere. I didn't ask anybody. I didn't consult a book. Didn't look it up. Just decided that that's how it is. Lands here becomes fact for me. And Butch and I pretty much started dating exclusively from that point on. Very, very difficult to date Butch, basically because he could hardly ever remember my name. You know, but if you're going to date an alcoholic, you can't let the fact that he doesn't remember your name stop you, you know, from going out with the guy. Otherwise, give it up, you know. I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg when you're going out with alcoholics, you know. Of course, you don't know that then. But you know, and he would call me Lorraine, Lucerne, you know, whatever. You know, I know my name is hard, you know, and it's difficult and it's different, and there's not very many of them. And my dad named me Larcine. I asked my dad what Larcine meant. He told me it was the name of a town in Scotland. You know, now I'm a researcher. I have written to Scotland. I have looked on the internet. I have written to the Tourism Bureau. I have gone through the history books. There has never, ever been a place called Larcine, Scotland, you know, that they've ever heard of. So I've decided that Larcine really stands for daughter was born when father was drunk, so this is the name you get stuck with, you know? Because I'm sure in a drunken stupor, my dad thought it was the name of a town in Scotland, you know? I'm sure that somewhere there's some reality that's in there. But anyway, that's my name, and it was hard for Butch to remember, but again, I would answer to anything even close, you know, and he knows it now, by God, and he knows, doesn't have any trouble remembering it now. But anyway, we started dating exclusively, and it was fun, and we had a great time, and I loved to take Butch to my little weenie high school parties, you know, and my little weenie friends would be there with their little weenie boyfriends, and I'd be there with Big Bad Butch, you know, and he was the whiskey drinking guy, and he liked to, you know, pour the big tumbler and chug-a-lug it, you know, and he was, you know, he was my gift to the party, you know, it's just really what it was, and he was fun to be around, and we had a good time, and we had a lot of fun, and he did things off the cuff, and it was just like, see, I always grew up in this home all the time, where we were always going to go places, we were always going to go do things, but then one of us would do some minor infraction, and that would be taken away from us. Now, again, I had no idea that it had anything to do with my dad being drunk that day, you know, and just looking for the minor infraction for why we couldn't go, you know, but here I am now with Butch, and he's drinking, and he's like, it's 10 o'clock at night, let's go to Disneyland, and boom, we'd all pop off in the car and go to Disneyland till 1 o'clock in the morning or whatever. I was having a ball with him. We were really having a great time, and it was a lot of fun. Now, from the very beginning, I want to tell you, you know, he was a drinker and he was a drug user, and it was always right up front and in my face. He never hid any of that kind of stuff from me. He was a daily drinker, as far as I knew. He loved to drink, he loved to party, and you know, and he was having a good time. And I share this with you because the day that I walked into Al-Anon, if you would have said to me, Larsine, did you have any idea that Butch drank as much as he did? Did you know that Butch was doing illegal drugs? The day I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting, I would have absolutely denied it. I would have said I had absolutely no idea. And I share this with you because this is how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism. Because when it gets too painful for me to look at, I just pretend it's not there anymore. I never knew, I didn't see. And therefore, I don't have to take any responsibility for what's going on in my life. When I'm here to tell you from the very beginning, he was upfront about it. There was no hiding liquor. There was no pretending it wasn't going on. You know, he was a disappearing drunk from the beginning. I didn't know he was a blackout drinker, but he was a blackout drinker from the very beginning, too. You know, and he'd be there, and he'd be around for a while, and then all of a sudden, poof, he'd be gone. You know, he'd be gone for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days. No one would know where he was, and then just as magically, he would show back up again. He didn't even know where he'd been. I never thought to question him about that, never thought that there might be something weird or odd about that. All I ever knew was that when he came to see me first. One morning I'd go out to work, and there he would be in the back seat of my car, sound asleep. You know, he would have breath that would knock a camel off of its feet, you know, but I never said, where were you, what have you been doing? No, are you kidding me? Now what happens is when he's missing for more than 2 days, I leave a blanket and a pillow in the back seat of the car. You know, because again, this is how I'm affected. Right away I'm compensating and taking care of, and I don't even know where this is coming from. I don't even know that it's going on. You know, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I'm not the person that's drinking. But anyway, Butch and I went around this madcap way for a couple of years, and then what ended up happening is that I got pregnant. You know, and I share this with you because later on, when our life got really, really bad behind the drinking, I thought, this is God's punishing me. This is the big punishment from above, because I am the big rule and regulation person, and now I've broken the big rule and regulation, and this is what I get. You know, and I had to be in Al-Anon a while before someone told me, you know, Larsine, if you're going to screw around and not use any birth control, you might get pregnant. You know, it's just a fact of life. It just might happen. But boy, if you're blaming God for what's going on in your life, you sure don't have to do anything about that either, do you? When it's the big punishment from above. You know, and again, these are the defenses and the things that I took on so that I could defend my behavior and what was going on with me. So I don't have to take responsibility about these are the choices that I've made. These are the consequences of my actions. You know, I'll blame God and I'll blame you rather than take responsibility for what's going on. You know, and I'm the big responsibility person. I mean, I am huge on that. Except for when it really affects me in that way where I come off in a bad light. Whoa, then it wasn't me again. See, one more time, the denial just works for me when I need it to work for me. But anyway, this was a big deal for me. It doesn't matter to me if it's a big deal for you or not, but it was a huge, huge deal for me. And when I was in Al-Anon my very first year, we have, in Southern California, we have the Al-Anon Family Groups Convention of Southern California once a year. And my very first year going was my first year in Al-Anon. And we do the thing where we get two adjoining hotel rooms, and we cram as many women into these two adjoining hotel rooms as we can. And then it seemed to me that first night, after we went to the speaker meeting that night, we went back up to the room, and we had the meeting after the meeting. And there was seven of us in the room, and we were all sharing, and it seemed to me that everybody was sharing their deepest, darkest secret. Now, I don't know that that's what they were doing, but that's what I heard. So when it came around my time to share, I shared with these ladies how I had to get married because I was pregnant. Seven in the room, six of them, it turns out, had to get married because they were pregnant. We decided the seventh was the sickest because she married an alcoholic and didn't have to. And so I got to learn you are just as sick as your secrets. You know, but again, this was a huge, huge, huge deal for me. And it got bigger and bigger and bigger in my mind because it was a bigger secret and a bigger secret and a bigger secret. And it got to the point that when, you know, I had a little boy as a result of that pregnancy, and it got to whenever that little boy's birthday came around, I became to resenting that little boy. Because it would just bring back all those memories, why my life was so crappy, how I got stuck in this situation. Again, one more time, not willing to look at my part, you know, these are my consequences, but getting ready to nail this on a little one-year-old, a two-year-old, a three-year-old. You know, because this is how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I don't even know it. You know, and I think I'm unaffected. I never think it's my problem. I always think that it's his problem. You know, and I guess share this with you, not because I'm proud of it, because this is where the disease of alcoholism took me. This is where I got to go. But anyway, it was a huge deal for me. And what ended up happening is Butch and I got married a month after our son was born. So if people said to me, were you pregnant when you got married? I said, no, because I wasn't. And you know, if you want to figure it out, you go ahead and figure it out. But words mean everything to me. And so anyway, so Butch and I ended up getting married a month after this child was born. Now, I want you to know that up until that point, I'd never said squat to Butch about his drinking or his drug use. Never said anything to him about it at all. Never had any discussions about it until the day after we got married. The day after we got married, I sat him in the kitchen chair, and I told him the rules and regulations of the marriage. And I told him that once a month we could get a babysitter, and we could go out and party, but that would be it, that we had a child. You know, I've got a vision, I've got a plan, we have to earn money, we have to take care of this, we have to buy a house, I have all this stuff that we're going to do, and this is what we're going to do. And I said to him, do you understand the rules and regulations of the marriage? He sat in the front chair, you know, or in the chair in the kitchen there, and he did this. You know, which to me was affirmative acknowledgement of the rules and regulations of the marriage. You know, today what I know is he was so loaded, his head was just going like this. And he heard what he wanted to hear, which was blah, 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 blah. And how do I know that? Because day three of our marriage, he doesn't come home all night long. You know, he doesn't come home all night long. The third day that we're married, and for me, the war began. The war began that day. I watched my mom for years say nothing, so I knew the silent treatment didn't work. I am proud, proud to stand before you and tell you my husband begged for the silent treatment. He never got it, not one time. I was like a little Pekingese dog, you know, just the minute he would walk in the door, just and curse and foul language. I can't even tell you where I heard this stuff from. And I don't know why. You know, again, information from nowhere lands here, becomes fact for me, because I was sure that if I said the right mothers and other words in the right consecutive order, that he would have this, like, spiritual awakening and have this realization, you know, of, oh, my gosh, look how I'm making my beautiful young bride cuss like a longshoreman. I must stop this behavior immediately. You know, I don't know why I thought that was going to happen, but I really believe that some sort of cursing in the right order would, like, shock him into the kind of behavior that I thought that he was supposed to be doing. No, I never wanted him not to drink, and I never really looked at the drinking because I didn't understand it. You know, I've gone to probably thousands now of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I've heard wonderful people in AA talk about, you know, about the disease of alcoholism, but I can probably go to AA meetings till the cows come home, and I cannot tell you about the compulsion to drink because it is not mine, because I can take a drink or not take a drink. It doesn't matter to me. And that knowledge hurt me a long time before I got to Al-Anon. Because, see, if I can take a drink or not take a drink, then why can't he? He must not love us, must not care about us. Why does he keep doing this stuff? Because I have absolutely no understanding about the disease of alcoholism. I don't know. You know, and as it says, lack of knowledge is our dilemma. You know, and one more time, you know, I took information from nowhere, it lands here, and it becomes fact for me. You know, I used to think he was drinking at me. He never told me that. You know, I used to think he was having fun. He never came home looking like he was having fun. But just all this stuff I would just think up, land here, become fact for me. You know, because when you're married to an alcoholic, you get a lot of downtime, a lot of alone time. I don't know if you did, but I certainly did. And that's a lot of thinking time. You know, and it's a lot of making up stuff all day long because that's all I have to do. And the negative disease of alcoholism, I never thought he was out there making baskets for the Sisters of Good Hope. You know, I mean, he was always out there doing the worst possible thing that he could be doing. You know, whether or not that was happening or not happening, I don't know. But again, I just sit around there and I just get the negative disease of alcoholism, how I am affected. And it gets progressively worse. You know, in the beginning, you know, my husband was just Mr. Happy Guy. He just liked to lay down or get drunk, have a good time, you know, then lay down and pass out. That's all he ever wanted to do. You know, I shared that one time, and he was sitting in the front row, and there was an AA guy sitting next to him, and the AA guy sitting next to him leaned over to Butch and said, "Butch, I don't think that's too much to ask for." You know, but it was more than I could give him, because there was just, you know, I was just so mad. The rage for me was from the very beginning. It was just huge for me, and it did. It started getting progressively worse to the point that, you know, like within 3 months, you know, this is within the first 3 months of our marriage. We've got the financial problems. All the stuff is going on. He's drinking all the time, doing all kinds of drugs. All this stuff is hitting the fan, and he comes home this one night, and to show you how drunk he was, he woke me up. You know, which he would never normally do. And he demanded to have his dinner, and he had never done anything like that, and it startled me. You know, this is like 2 o'clock in the morning. It kind of scared me. So I scurried into the kitchen, but then I started waking up, and I remembered who he was dealing with. And I had made this Mexican casserole that night that called for one jalapeno pepper, but I had a whole can of them in the refrigerator. So I cut up every single one of these jalapeno peppers and just stuffed it in his little portion, you know. And he's so drunk he ate it. His mouth must have been on flame and fire. And then he did what I wanted him to do, and that was go in the bathroom and puke his brains out. You know, because I don't know how you feel, but when my alcoholic throws up, I get a warm feeling that just lasts me for days, you know. I mean, it's just, you know, because it's like, you know, again, that's what it turns into. Here we are 3 months into our marriage, you know, and I want you to know that, you know, when Butch and I got married, positively the driving force behind that was the fact that we had a child. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But I also want you to know the day that Butch and I got married, I believe that I loved my husband. I believe that he loved me. I believe that we were both really sincere about our marriage vows, that we did want to love and honor and cherish each other. You know, but what Butch and I didn't know was it wasn't just Butch and Larsine that got married that day. It was also the disease of alcoholism. You know, and I'm here to tell you the disease of alcoholism doesn't love or cherish anything. It absolutely positively means to tear your family apart by any way that it can. Whether it comes through the alcoholic or the non-drinking Al-Anon, however the deal works, it's going to manipulate its way any way it can, the negative disease of alcoholism, and just tear your family apart. Because that's just really what ended up happening to my family. We just got ripped apart from the inside out. And I had no idea that I was dealing with alcoholism. Absolutely none whatsoever. Because like I say, I don't have the compulsion to drink, so I don't think that he has. I think he just doesn't know how to drink. I think he just doesn't know how to mind. You know, so one time I sent him... And I pour myself a drink of alcohol, you know, and I take a sip of it, and then I look at my watch, and I go, okay, guys, it's 6 o'clock, it's time for me to go home for dinner now. I pick up the imaginary car keys, and I walk to the door. I come back, I go, can you do that? You know, he does this, you know, okay, then why don't you just do that? Because that's all I wanted him to do, was come home at 6 o'clock for dinner. You know, I don't know that once he takes the first drink, the deal is over. You know, I don't know that once he takes the first drink, it's a done deal for him. There is no more choice for him, because I don't understand the disease of alcoholism. That's not what I know is going on. You know, and it just keeps getting progressively worse. I did everything I could think of. One night he's laying in bed and I start whispering to him while he's passed out, you don't want to drink. You just want to work and bring Larsine the check. You don't want to drink. You just want to work and bring Larsine the check. I mean, we did this, I don't know, hours, 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 hours. Why? Information from nowhere lands here, becomes fact for me. It might work. You know, because who do you talk to? I'm not talking to anybody about this stuff. I'm not going to work. When I go to work, and I go to work on Monday, people are talking about the picnic they had the day before, or the, you know, flowers they planted in their garden, or, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, how do I tell them? You know, I didn't see my husband for the last 3 days. How do I say, I found my husband, but we lost his truck? You know, I mean, you know, how do you talk about, you know, these people? So I say nothing. I say we had a picnic. I say we had a barbecue. I say we planted flowers. And again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism. And I start living the lie. That, to me, is what alcoholism, more than anything, is just a big, fat lie. And I just started living the lie. You know, in the beginning, it was always my husband's wrongs were like this big. Just huge, you know, blowing his whole paycheck, just, you know, not coming home, just doing the things he was doing were that big. I don't know that mine started out that big, but it wasn't very long. It wasn't very long at all before mine got just as big. Mine just, and again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I don't even know it. It's just the way the deal goes. But, you know, then I did all kinds of things, and I decided, oh, one kid's not enough. We need another kid. Don't got enough pressure on this guy as it is, you know, so get pregnant with child number two. You know, and again, just stuff I keep thinking up. I didn't have a child because I was anxious to bring another child in the world. I had another child because I wanted to fix his drinking, because I thought it would fix his drinking. I thought it would fix him. You know, and these are the you know, the things that I go to that I'm trying to do to fix another person. And I don't even understand what it is I am trying to fix because I don't understand the disease of alcoholism. But I'm good at faking it. I'm just good at faking it. And then we get to this one part, and I get this call from one of my husband's friends, and all my husband's friends at this point I refer to as scum of the earth people, you know, because that's just what they are. They're just scum of the earth people. And these people happen to be drug dealers. And they call me, and my husband is such a pig, and he is just so wasted and so out of it at their house that they, the drug dealers, are going to call the police if I don't come and get him. This is the shape that he is in. So, of course, I put on my cape, and off I go. And he's sure enough, I get there, and it still cracks me up to think about it today, because they, the drug dealers, are peeking through the Venetian blinds, you know, watching to see if I'll come and get him. And he's in their front yard, and I kind of, you know, I helped him get up, and I just pushed him, and he landed in the back seat of the car. And I drive home, and I go put our son up in his crib, and I come down to get my husband, and he's made the fatal mistake of trying to get out of the car without my help. You know, and he's fallen into the street, he's hit his head on the curb, and now blood is gushing out. You know, it's just gushing out all over the place. And I'd like to tell you that I was concerned about his well-being, you know, but I absolutely was not. What I want to do is I want to get him off the street before anybody sees him, you know. So, but now, you know, he's like, you know, almost 200 pounds of wet washcloth, and I can't pick him up. So I've got him by the ankles, and I'm trying to heave this guy up over the curb and walk him down the sidewalk into our house. And why we call these people normies, I have not a flaming clue. But this guy comes by, and here I've got a guy bleeding from his head by the ankles, and this guy comes by in the car and goes, "Are you having a problem?" This is what the normal people say. And I go, "Yes, my husband's fallen and he can't get up." And so he helps me get him up, and we lived in a townhouse then, and our bedroom was upstairs, and I had to have him all the way up that flight of stairs because he had a head injury. He needed to be in the bed. And now as we're going up the stairs, of course, the words are now flying between him and I, and Mr. Good Samaritan no longer wants to participate. So we get to the top of the stairs, and then he's gone. He's like a bullet. So I kind of drag Butch over, and he lands on the bed. And now there's a nice little puddle of blood on my bedspread, and now I'm panic-stricken. I mean, I'm hysterical. So I call 911. I'm so hysterical, they don't know what's going on. They send the paramedics. They sent a hook and ladder truck. They sent the police. They even got a hold of my mother, you know. And I'm in the bedroom with the baby, patting the baby. Oh, how terrible. My husband's hurt himself and stuff. And then the Redondo Beach police come into me, and they go, "Mrs. Gantner, your husband says he injured himself because you pushed him down a flight of stairs." I tell the police I hadn't done that, but if they'd prop him up, I'd be happy to push him down in front of the Redondo Beach Police Department. And they tell me that's not necessary, and they clean him all up, and he's just got a little weenie cut, you know, he needs like 3 stitches, you know, but he's so drunk, he's got to go by ambulance. Now, I don't know how your neighborhood is, but a hook and ladder truck had my neighbors all out front there, you know, and then here comes Butch, his usual friendly, warm, loving self. "Hiya, Frank, hiya, Joe," you know, on the gurney, and I come out behind a newspaper like they won't know it's me, because I was big on anonymity back then, you know, and just the insanity that goes along with it. And somewhere in all that insanity, I know I called the Council on Alcoholism. And I have no idea why, but I know I called the Council on Alcoholism. And I told this woman everything that was going on in my house. And I'd say, blah, 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 and she would go, "I know." And I'd say some more stuff, and she would just, no matter what I said, she said, "I know, I know, I know, I know." And she asked me if she could send me some Al-Anon literature. And I know I gave her the right address because I remember the big brown envelope coming to the house. But that, is to this day, is where my memory stops. I can't tell you from that day to this day if I opened up that envelope or what happened beyond that point. Because I know what happened for me. Because what ended up happening is it took whatever it took, 3 days, a week, for whatever, for that envelope to get there, and the rhinoceros went back to being a coffee table for me again. Because one more time, now he was being good. Now he was doing what he was supposed to be doing. This time, it'll be different. You know, and again, that's the disease of alcoholism. You know, and at the end of my husband's drinking, it was pretty brutal. You know, the last 9 months are almost just about a blackout for him and a whiteout for me. It was not a pleasant time for us at all. And I remember one of the very last drunks that he was on, and I was so mad at him. We were supposed to go to some family function, and one more time, he's so drunk and he's so loaded that we can't go. And I'm sitting there toe-to-toe just yelling and screaming at him. And I became very conscious of our two little boys, who at that time were 5 and 3 years old. And they were standing on either side of me, and they were yanking on my pant legs. And I looked down at those little boys, and they were just sobbing. And they were begging me, their mom, to please stop yelling at their dad. You know, and I would like to tell you I had a moment of clarity then, but I absolutely, positively did not. You know, what ended up happening for me is I just started yelling at those little boys because I'm just full of rage. That's all I know. How dare they tell me to stop yelling at their dad? Dad's the reason that, you know, we have all this chaos going on in our life. And by the time I get done yelling at these two little innocent children, I watch the drunken, loaded father walking out the front door. And I, the sober mother, turn to the drunken parent and say, where the hell do you think you're going? And the drunken father turns to the sober mother and says, I'm leaving because we're upsetting the children. You know, and I don't tell you this story because I'm proud of it. This is where the disease of alcoholism took me, and I'm not even the person that's drinking. I'm the sober parent here. I'm the one who's supposed to be looking out for everybody's best interest here. And I'm thinking that I am. I'm always thinking that I am. You know, I do the things I do, and I hide behind the guise of being a good wife behind it. I used to yell and scream at my husband when he was hungover and remorseful and know that he was sorry. You know, when he would look into my eyes and promise me that he wouldn't do that anymore, I knew that he meant that. I knew he wasn't lying. I knew he was as truthful as he could be that day. You know, but still, and I would hear that little voice in me say, stop, Larsine, stop it. You're not helping. You know, you're making this situation worse, but by God, I wouldn't let go of it. I just keep biting at it and biting at it and biting at it. You know, because I don't know. All I know is I just keep pushing. I'm pushing in the wrong direction, so I just keep pushing harder in the wrong direction. You know, again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism. Somewhere in there, I went to an Al-Anon meeting. I'd gone to school with this girl, and I know that her mother had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew her dad was going to Al-Anon. And so I called up her dad, and I asked him to take me to an Al-Anon meeting, and he agreed to do so. Don't ask me why. I still don't even know why to this day why I went to that Al-Anon meeting. But I know what happened. I sat in that front row, and I heard absolutely nothing. You know, because I'm here to tell you I wasn't willing. And if you're not willing, nothing is going to change for you. Absolutely nothing. Nothing changed for me because I wasn't willing. It was a great meeting. They were warm, and they had great literature on the back, you know, but they didn't have the piece of literature I wanted, and that's the literature that says how to get them to do what you want them to do. You know, because that's all I was interested in. I was not interested in no stupid merry-go-round named denial. You know, I wanted to get, how do you get them to mind? That's what I wanted to know. And then again, sitting in that front row, you know, I didn't hear what I wanted to hear. So therefore, you know, and if you're new here, it's so easy to find, you know, some reason why you shouldn't be here. It's so easy. It's just, it doesn't even take any effort at all. Because when I sat in that front row, I found my reason. When they were reading something, they said, if somebody's drinking bothers you, then you should come to Al-Anon. Well, there you go. You know, that Al-Anon works for people who are bothered. His drinking pisses me off. I want to know where the meetings are for the pissed people, please. You know, I mean, flies bother me. I could even deal with bothered. You know, I'm at a new nirvana level here. You know, and that's and therefore, you know, you guys didn't know what it was like. And I'm here to tell you, you know, but if they would have said to me when I was sitting in that front row, Larsine, do you want your life to be different? God, did I want my life to be different? Larsine, what are you willing to do about it? Nothing. Because it's not my problem. You fix him and I'll be okay. Because that's the information I picked up that landed here and became fact for me. You know, on my husband's last drunk, on a scale of 1 to 10, I wouldn't even give it a 5. You know why that's the one that got him drunk? I have absolutely no idea. You know, and that's his story, and I know that God was working in his life. I don't think God was working in mine, but I believe that God was working in my husband's life. Because that night, they just opened up this hospital program that was a little ways away from where we lived, and I called and I told them about my husband, and they said I could have my husband committed if he were drunk, but that once he sobered up, if he didn't want to stay, they wouldn't keep him, because they were only interested in people that wanted to be sober. And they gave me the number of the doctor on call that night, and my husband got arrested for drunk driving that evening. And that's no big deal, because my husband's been arrested lots of times for drunk driving. It's no big deal in my house at all. But that next day when I went to go pick him up from the police, you know, this is how I know that God was working in his life, because I didn't say nothing. No words came out of my mouth. And believe you me, it takes a power greater than anything you've seen in your life to keep my mouth shut. And I couldn't even figure out why. You know, it was just, he didn't say anything, I didn't say anything. And that just never happens. That just never happens. And I took him home, and he went upstairs, and he stayed upstairs for 2 days. And then he came down, and he said, you know, as they, you know, they're so quick, the understatement of the century. Larsine, I think I have a problem with my drinking. Yeah, no shit. But I didn't do anything. I handed him the phone number. I handed him the phone number. I said, this is a hospital, and they're supposed to be able to help alcoholics. You know, I don't know if they can help you or not. And I left the room. You know, and I believe with all my heart that my husband made his surrender, you know, that day, and that God literally pushed me out of the way so that my husband could find sobriety. Because I didn't make the phone calls, and that's what I do. I am the grand organizer of the universe. That is what I do. And yet I didn't do any of that stuff. I handed him the phone number, and I left the room. And he made all the arrangements to do the deal. And I ended up taking him to the hospital, and because of all the drugs and alcohol, they knew he was going to go through DT, so he had to go into the psychiatric unit first. And so when I'm getting ready to leave, and, you know, I get to the end of the big double doors at the end there, and And he calls my name, and I'm sure it's because he changed his mind, which is fine with me, because I'm not too happy about leaving him in the psychiatric unit at this point. What will the neighbor say? You know, but instead, I walked back to him, and he reaches into his pocket, and he handed me the Valium that he brought in case of emergency. And he never parted with a Valium in his life, and I knew he was done. You know, so I went home, and I took it, because I was just a basket case. And I was absolutely wacko, you know. And now you got to know, this is my situation. I've got a husband in the psychiatric unit going through the DTs, and I've got, you know, I've got a kindergartner and a preschooler, and to cheer Butch up, I would take him what the kids had made, you know, in preschool and kindergarten. But no, he wanted to show me what he made in occupational therapy that day, you know, because it's all about the alcoholic when they get sober, let me tell you, boy. So I take it home, you know, and I'd show the boys, look what Daddy did. He's sober now. We'd hang it on the refrigerator. We were so proud. Ooh, look at Daddy. And you know, and they put him on the alcoholism side of that hospital, and I'm very proud to tell you that from that day to this day, he hasn't had a drink. You know, he's been sober that whole entire time, and coming this July the 21st, he'll celebrate his 24th birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my heart knows absolutely no end of gratitude to AA. You know, he was dead. He was absolutely positively dead. I'd come home from work, and I would be afraid he'd OD'd. I didn't know what to do. I'd be all freaked out. And, you know, and the kids, they were always so good with their dad. I mean, he'd be laying in the kitchen floor, and they'd tie Tinker toys to him, pretend he's Gulliver, you know. And, you know, they just went with the flow with him all the time, you know, and stuff. And, you know, and I am really, really grateful to AA for giving me back my husband. And and when I cry, it's not because he lived, because then I was rooting for death. Believe you me, I wanted to be a widow so bad. And but, you know, I cry because I know what would have happened if my husband would have died. There would have been one really angry woman raising a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. I don't know how that family would have been, but I don't think I'd want to be around it. And I wouldn't want to pass on that legacy to my kids. And that's why I cry, because I'm so grateful, you know, for that part of it. But anyway, he got sober. Whoopee. And it was it was grand. It was wonderful. We were having a good time. And it was 5-week program, and he did the deal. And they didn't do any family nothing back then. It was all about the alcoholic. We just read the chapter to the wives. I've never read such a god-awful chapter in my entire life. This is what I read. They get sober, kiss their butt. That's what I read. And I'm like, forget it. I am not participating in this in any way, shape, or form. But anyway, after he goes to the big hospital thing, now he's supposed to go to meetings. Now, I'm a helper. You know how helpful I am. So I go with him the first 6 months he's going to AA to make sure he hears the stuff he's supposed to hear. And you know, but after 6 months, I got tired of going, and I thought he should too. I'm like, God, there's only 12 steps. How stupid are you? You know, I've done them all like 6 times already myself. What's the deal here? You know, but he made it clear to me that AA was the most important thing in his life, you know, and that's what he was going to do. So, boom, that's what he's doing. He's going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is the most important thing in his life, and I just quit going with him. And but occasionally, you know, there'd be an anniversary meeting or something be going on, and he would invite me to go to the meeting, and I would go. And I'd go to the AA meeting, and AA women would walk up to me. Are you Butch's wife? Yes, I am. We love him. He's so wonderful. I'm like, you know, it's just... You know, because it was just like he got sober and he was the hero. You know, all of a sudden he's Mr. Wonderful, you know, and all this other crap that went down the pike and how I held it all together by God and, you know, and stuff. And I was told I should go to A. Al-Anon meeting when he got sober, you know. And so I'm a rule and regulation person. I went to A. Al-Anon meeting. I sat in the front row and I told those people, I said, you know, I came to you, I forget how long, 2 or 3 years ago, I asked you how to get my husband sober. You didn't tell me squat, you know. And I said, I got him sober now and I'm not going to tell you how I did it. And and so who needs you? You know, nanny, nanny, I win. Because one more time, I think if he's sober, I win. I think it's done and it's over with. You know, and what ended up happening is my husband went to AA. My husband had a program. He worked it. You know, I had nothing. I had nothing. Now, I went to AA meetings with him. They always made me feel welcome in AA meetings. I heard a lot of good things in AA meetings. But I'm not an alcoholic, and my recovery does not lie in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my recovery lies in the rooms of Al-Anon, but I did not know that. And so what ended up happening was I just was mad. All I know is mad. All I know is rage and mad. You know, it's like my friend Crazy Jean says, it's like they get sober and you're out of a job. Because that's just what it was like for me. I had nowhere to go. And And so what ended up happening is he decided that after he was sober almost a couple years, he was going to go to a conference. We'd never done that before. I'd never allowed him to do that. But now he had 2 years of sobriety almost, and by God, he was going to go. And it was going to be in Palm Springs, California. Well, my God, there's going to be alcoholic women in bikinis running around. You know, I can't let him go there unescorted. You know, so I went to go watch him. And what he ended up doing was trick me into going to the family meeting. You know, and what happened was that this family meeting, they have an AA speaker, an Al-Anon speaker, an Alateen speaker. None of them were related. Three entirely separate people, but they shared a family format. You know, and I know what happened for me that day is sitting in that audience is that I became this much willing. Mind you, it was only this much, but it was this much willing to do something different. So when I came back from that conference, you know, I started going to Al-Anon right away, and I started coming here for all the right reasons that time. I didn't come here to get him sober. He already was. I didn't come to keep him sober. He was doing fine on his own. I came because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I didn't know how to turn off the mad. I just wanted to learn how to turn off being the mad. And so I came to my Al-Anon meeting. I go, okay, what do? They go, we get a sponsor, we work the steps, we read the literature, we go to meetings. Just hallelujah, tell me the rules and regulations, sign me up, here I am. I got a sponsor right away. I got a sponsor who's, I come to Al-Anon, and I go to lots and lots of meetings, and I hear people share all the time how they still don't have a sponsor because they're looking for somebody just like them. How stupid can you be? You know, why do you want somebody just like you? Then she knows what you do. You don't want anybody to know that. You know, so I got a sponsor who was completely the opposite of me. I got someone who was older than my mother, who was divorced from her alcoholic, had never lived with sobriety. She didn't have any little kids. She had one adopted son that was grown, and she had a thick Dutch accent. She could hardly understand a bloody word she said. And so I asked her to be my sponsor. And I remember the very first time I used her as a sponsor. My husband was going to work one morning, and he had a dead battery, and he asked me to jump his truck. And after I jumped his truck, he ran out of gas. Now, what I know happened is this made him angry, which is fine. You know, I've learned in the program it's okay to be angry, just not live there for 27,000 years. You know, but the deal was, but what I heard is he got mad, what I heard is he yelled at me. Now, he didn't do that, but that's what I heard. So because he yelled, I do what I always do, I yelled right back at him. He stormed off to work, I went upstairs, called my sponsor, and reported his behavior, and told her exactly what had happened. And when I was done, she says, when Butch gets home tonight, you're telling him you're sorry for what you said. And it was like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, Jeannie doesn't know how we do things in America, you know. She missed the crucial who started it, which I always think is so important. But I didn't want to tell her that she wasn't listening or that I thought she was stupid. So I started telling her the story again so she would pick up on all the information that she missed. And then halfway through the second telling, she said, don't tell me the story again. I heard you the first time. And please don't ever call me again and start a conversation with Butch said or Butch did. I am not Butch's sponsor. I am Larsine's sponsor. And for what Larsine says, for what Larsine said to her husband, she owes him an amends. It was unkind and uncalled for. I'll see you at the meeting tonight. Goodbye. Click. End of conversation. Now, I learned valuable lessons. Never call your sponsor first thing in the morning because you got all day long to think about what she told you. You know, never call your sponsor when you're going to see her that night at a meeting because she's going to want to know if you follow direction. You know, and I'm a rule and regulation person. I have no choice. I have to do this. So I got all day long to think about this. So when Butch walked in the door, you know, at the end of the day after work, he came in the door. I told him I was sorry I let his shitty attitude affect me the way that it had, you know, and that I would try and do better in the future. Now, I know today that's not the best amends you can make, but what you need to know is before that, I'd never said I was sorry to him for anything, because it was always his fault, always his fault. But what I was that day from sponsored direction was this much willing to do something different. And that's all you have to be is just this much willing on any given day, just this much willingness. Because I see people beat themselves out of Al-Anon all the time because they don't think they're getting it fast enough. It's not working for me because like it's working for you, so I must not be doing it right. It's not working for me. It's nothing to do with that. Often we compare how our program is working with somebody who's been in the program for 20 or 30 years. If you want 20 or 30 years of Al-Anon, you have to go for 20 or 30 years. That's just the way it works. But if you're this much willing, this much at a time, it will change for you. I know that because that's how it was for me. I was this much willing to make amends, and that was a step forward. If I'd had to make that perfect amends the very first time, you'd have somebody different up here today. You know, and that was good enough for my sponsor, too. I made the attempt. I tried. I did the best I could under that day with the information that I had. And from that day to this, this much, this much, this much at a time, that's what the journey has literally been for me, just that much at a time. You know, I had a big deal with God when I got here because, you know, I gave God plenty of opportunities to work in my life. You know, I would say to God, God, if you're really there, make him walk in the door right now. Now, how hard should that be for God?
I mean, holy crap, if he's God, why can't he make one little weaselly, weenie guy walk in the door right now? Never happened. So therefore, information from nowhere, God does not answer my prayers. He doesn't hear what I say. And I spent a lot of time yelling at God and being angry with God. So I didn't want to have anything to do with the God part, the spiritual part of the program. And I remember going to my meeting one night, and I used to go to this little Wednesday night step study group, and they all knew my struggle with the concept of God. And there was maybe 12 or 13 people at the meeting that night. And that night, everybody in that meeting went around the room and shared about their God for my benefit. Strictly for my benefit, so that maybe I could find a God of my understanding that I could start to use, so that I could have a God in my program. And this was a meeting that Crazy Gene used to have at his home, and Gene is the guy that took me to that very first meeting. And after the end of the meeting, Gene said to me, "Well, Larsine, did it help you? You know, can you use somebody's God here until you find a God of your own?" You know, and I said, "Gene, I appreciate everybody sharing, but I'm not going to get the God thing. I don't think I'm ever going to get the God thing." And then Gene said, "You know, Larsine, why God gave you ears?" And Gene is a very sarcastic, nasty man. And I know this. And so I said to him, "So I can hear what you guys are trying to tell me. I know. He goes, "Well, in most people's cases, that's true. But in your case, God gave you ears so you'd have something to hold on to while you yank your head out of your ass." And that's where my head was. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. You know, that was the deal for me, because that's where my head is when I don't want to hear, when I don't want to be this much willing. That's where my head is. It's full of that crap, so I don't have to hear and I don't have to do. So what I did that night is I just went home and I went out in my backyard and I looked up, you know, and I said, "God, this is Larsine Gatner," and I gave him my address and my phone number, you know, and I don't know how to pray and I don't know what I'm supposed to do, but here I am. You know, they say that I have to come to you and that you will, you know, that you'll help me, you know, go down this path that's Al-Anon and show me how to live my life. You know, I'm pretty much from that day to this, that's pretty much been my basic prayer every day. God, just show me the way to go. Because I don't know the way to go by myself. By myself, I will go to the dark side every single time. That's just the way it is for me. You know, and over the course of time, you know, there's lots of stuff, and God knows I got all day tomorrow to talk to you, so, you know, I'm just going to fast forward a little bit so you guys can have some fun fellowship. But, the road has just been this much at a time for me. Just this much at a time, you know, and sometimes I fight it and sometimes it's easy skating. And I don't know why sometimes it's hard and why sometimes it's easy. I have absolutely no idea. My husband and I have been through a lot of ups and downs with our boys. I remember when my husband went through the hospital, the one thing that the doctor there did tell me was that alcoholism might be a hereditary disease. My boys then were about 5 and 3 years old. I went home, I sat those boys in the kitchen chair, made them both raise their right hand and swear to me that they would not be alcoholics or drug addicts. They both did this, you know, and off we went. And, you know, and they've had their trials and tribulations. And my oldest boy went through all kinds of really bad stuff, and he was even to the point that he was an Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 months when he was 16 years old, and then he decided he wasn't alcoholic anymore. And he went back out there for a while, and now, you know, he's married, and he's got a one-month-old baby, and he's doing just gangbusters, and he has his occasional beer and all that stuff. You know, maybe he's not alcoholic. Maybe he's just, you know, he was just a teenage thing that he went through, and he's doing fine right now. My youngest son is 24 years old. He likes to call me and go, "Mom, I'm just drinking beer now. I've given up the hard stuff." And he gets arrested for drunk in public. You know, who gets arrested for that anymore? You know, and I mean, but these are the things that go on. But what allows me to be with you today is, again, those two words, unconditional love, that I have learned here. You know, my kids have been going to AA meetings and Al-Anon meetings since they were 5 and 3 years old. They know where to go. They absolutely positively know where to go. And I know it's not my gift to give to them. I'm their mom, and it's not my gift to give to them. Whether, you know, they're going to get it or not get it, it's not my concern. You know, what I get to do is I get to love those boys unconditionally, and they know that I love them unconditionally. That's the deal in our family. I don't always like what they do. I certainly don't approve of what goes on, and I certainly don't have to participate in the things that I don't like. But what I got to learn here was how to love my family unconditionally. It blows my mind that I had to come to a room full of strangers to learn how to love my own family, but that's the gift that you guys have given me. You know, I just want to share a couple other stories before I sit down, just to let you know how sick I am all the time. I was about 15 years in Al-Anon, and my husband and I had been to a conference. And it was just one of those fabulous, you know, speakers were wonderful, the marathon meetings they had, the workshops, just everything about this conference was just unbelievably spiritual, wonderful, laugh, cry, the whole nine yards, so much fellowship, hug, friendship, just everything you want when you go there. And we come home Sunday, and it's like, you know, and you come in the door, and you've just been to one of those things, and you're just like, you're floating, you know, serenity's coming out every orifice of your body, whoa, you know, you're just full of the light of the program. program type of a thing going on. And that's how we were feeling. And then my at that time, my son, my youngest son, who was then 20 years old and living at home with us, was living at home with us. That's the bottom line. And what I do for exercise is I have a treadmill in my garage, and I try and do that every day. And so when I got home from this conference, I got into my little treadmill walking clothes, and I go out to the treadmill, and next to my treadmill is my son's weight bench. And I walk over to the weight bench, and on the weight bench I find a woman's driver's license. I pick it up. There's lots of information on this license. This woman is 32 years old. She lives in Glendora, California. That's what's on the license. Now I immediately decide that she's been in the house, in my house, over the weekend, had sex with my 20-year-old son, has two children, wants to marry him, and call me mom. I am there right now in less than 10 seconds. Information from nowhere, fuego. So I go run into the house with the driver's license, and I lay it down in front of my husband, who is laying on the couch, his favorite form of exercise, and I show him the driver's license, and he just looks at me, nothing, because he's got no imagination. He has nothing. So I tell him what I think happened over the weekend, and his eyes roll back in his head like they so often do when I'm talking to him, and he says, "You are crazy, you are nuts, call Carol. Carol is my sponsor now, call Carol immediately." So I go and I call Carol, and I'm all hysterical over the phone over what I think has happened over the weekend. Now, Carol is my sponsor, and I love her to pieces. She rarely, rarely gives me direct instruction ever. But that day she told me to shut up. Just shut up. Just be quiet. And she says, "And when that kid comes home, don't you dare accuse him or ask him any crap about what garbage you made up in that sick head of yours. That kid is having enough difficulties and enough hard time as it is without you throwing more crap on him, without you trying to make him feel bad about some garbage that you made up in your own head. Don't you dare say one word to that kid." And I didn't. And it was easy because, as it turns out, my son works, he was working different odd jobs and going to school, and my job, turns out I don't see him for 2 days. And what ends up happening is, like, 2 days later, I'm in the kitchen, and I'm making dinner, and he walks into the kitchen. Now, I've forgotten about the driver's license, because it has been 2 days, and all kinds of crap's come and gone already. But he walks in with the driver's license in his hand, and he goes, "Mom, what do you do when you find a driver's license?" Now, I don't tell him what I do when I find a driver's license, because it's just not a good example. But see, one more time, I would have dumped all that crap on that kid. I would have made him feel bad about stuff that didn't even go on. Wasn't there enough stuff going on? Again, things I've learned in the program. It takes just as much energy to put out positive thoughts towards somebody as it does to negatives. When I'm fearful about my children or what's going on in their life, and somebody told me too what fear stands for, forgetting everything's all right. Most of the time, it is. I just go there. And that's the deal. But instead of, so now when I get fearful because I'm scared about the stuff that's going on in their life, I just turn them over to God. I just say a prayer for them. I just think positive thoughts their way. It takes just as much energy to send the positive as it does the negative. And that lets me have the unconditional love. My God, those guys are 29 and 26 years old now. When am I going to let it go? When am I going to know that I've done the best that I know how to do, and now it's up to them? I just get to be the best mom I know how to be today. You guys gave me that. About a month ago, I was up in a conference up in South Dakota, and my son and his wife were expecting my first grandson, and I am very hot for this kid to arrive. And I know that I'm going to be gone because I've made this commitment very far in advance, and I know that the baby is due 2 days before this weekend that I am supposed to be gone. So because I am going to this conference for Al-Anon, I talk to God and make my deal. Okay, the baby can come on Monday when I'm back, okay? Now, I know God went like this. I'm positive of it, But no sooner does my plane land in frickin' South Dakota nowhereville that my cell phone rings and my husband's on the phone and this baby boy has been born. And I was pissed. I was so angry. I called my sponsor and wanted to resign from Al-Anon on the spot, turn in my resignation. I was just livid, ranting, raving, carrying on, going nuts. And my sponsor tells me what she always does, "You can't quit today, you can quit tomorrow." But today we're just going to pray about it and see what goes on. Now, to show you how crazy I was, she had her sponsor call me. When your grand sponsor calls you, you have crossed the line. Let me tell you, you have crossed the line. You have really gone over the top. And so, because they're bringing out the big guns now. But my grand sponsor, as my sponsor, was nothing but loving and kind. And they reminded me, "Larsine, did you turn your will and your life over to the care of God this morning?" "Yes, I did." "Did you mean that when you did that? Or was those just words you say? You walk in the walk, you talk in the talk." And one more time, they leave me with those thoughts that I get to think about. And then I get to think about, here's this beautiful baby that was born this day. How grateful I should be that I have this beautiful, healthy grandson. And what am I thinking about? I'm making it all about me. Boy, poor Larsine doesn't get to be there when this baby's born. Because, see, I made all these rules and regulations about how it was supposed to be when the baby's born. The beauty of the program is you can change the rules and regulations. Because, see, the next day I made it, as long as I see the baby within 48 hours, change the rule and regulation, you know, more open up those stupid boundaries, you know, make them a little bit wider to fit into whatever it needs to be fit in. And I did what I could do. I sent flowers, I sent a cake, you know, anything I could order on my cell phone, you know, I just did all that stuff that I could do. And then I got there, and within 48 hours, I got to pick up my grandson and hold him and kiss him and be grateful. And be glad that I got to be of service where I was supposed to be when I was supposed to be there. Did I turn my will and my life over to the care of God today, or didn't I? Do I believe that, or don't I believe that? You know, those are the things that we get to get here. You know, otherwise, I'd still be moaning and groaning about that baby being born someplace, and I wasn't there, and poor Larsine, isn't that a shame? And what did Larsine get? She got a healthy, beautiful baby grandson, you know, forever and ever and ever. You know, and how grateful I am for that, how grateful I should have been from the very beginning. But left alone, by myself, I will go to the dark side. That's why you pick up the phone. That's why I go to meetings. That's why I call people as soon as I know I'm going crazy and I'm going nuts, so that they can put me on that path. They remind me about what it is to be here. You know, and that's what you guys give me. That's why we need to hold on so tight to each other. That's why it's so important to go to the meetings. So important to use the phone when you need to call somebody. Those are tools we just can't part with. I don't care how long you're here. You know, this was 1 week before my 22nd birthday in Al-Anon. You know, and I'm doing the stuff. I go to meetings. I'm sponsored. I do the steps. I do all the stuff. But left alone for 5 minutes, I go to the dark side. Without you guys, that's where I would live. You know, and I'm just so grateful to you for being here for me. And I just want to thank you. I want you to enjoy the rest of the evening and your fellowship and fun. And I hope we have a good time tomorrow. And, you know, she talked about the girl standing there on the fence. When she sent me the flyer, I said, I'll put her on a cliff. That'd be more like it for me. But we're going to do the best that we can. And I love you guys. And thank you so much for having me. Thanks, Sarcy.